Howard appeared to be an amiable, grandfatherly type, but he was actually a bitter old man who felt cheated by life. He had never reached the pinnacle of the New England electric system, and he deeply resented it. "Passed over," he told me repeatedly, "because I refused to buy the company line." He had been forced into retirement, and then, unable to tolerate staying at home with his wife, had accepted a consulting job with Maine. This was his second assignment, and I had been warned by both Einar and Charlie to watch out for him. They described him with words like stubborn, mean, and vindictive. As it turned out, Howard was one of my wisest teachers, although not one I was ready to accept at the time. He had never received the type of training Claudine had given me. I suppose they considered him too old, or perhaps too stubborn. Or maybe they figured he was only in it for the short run, until they could lure in a more pliable full-timer like me. In any case, from their standpoint, he turned out to be a problem. Howard clearly saw the situation and the role they wanted him to play, and he was determined not to be a pawn. All the adjectives Einar and Charlie had used to describe him were appropriate, but at least some of his stubbornness grew out of his personal commitment not to be their servant. I doubt he had ever heard the term economic hitman, but he knew they intended to use him to promote a form of imperialism he could not accept. He took me aside after one of our meetings with Charlie. He wore a hearing aid and fiddled with the little box under his shirt that controlled its volume. "This is between you and me," Howard said in a hushed voice. We were standing at the window in the office we shared, looking out at the stagnant canal that wound past the PLN building. A young woman was bathing in its foul waters, attempting to retain some semblance of modesty by loosely draping a sarong around her otherwise naked body. "They'll try to convince you that this economy is going to skyrocket," he said. "Charlie's ruthless. Don't let him get to you." His words gave me a sinking feeling, but also a desire to convince him that Charlie was right. After all, my career depended on pleasing my main bosses. "Surely this economy will boom," I said, my eyes drawn to the woman in the canal. "Just look at what's happening." "So there you are," he muttered, apparently unaware of the scene in front of us. "You've already bought their line, have you?" A movement up the canal caught my attention. An elderly man had descended the bank, dropped his pants, and squatted at the edge of the water to answer nature's call. The young woman saw him, but was undeterred. She continued bathing. I turned away from the window and looked directly at Howard. "I've been around," I said. "I may be young, but I just got back from 3 years in South America. I've seen what can happen when oil is discovered. Things change fast." "Oh, I've been around, too," he said mockingly. "A great many years. I'll tell you something, young man. I don't give a damn for your oil discoveries and all that. I forecasted electric loads all my life, during the Depression, World War II, times of bust and boom. I've seen what Route 128's so-called Massachusetts miracle did for Boston, and I can say for sure that no electric load ever grew by more than 7 to 9% a year for any sustained period, and that's in the best of times. 6% is more reasonable.